Colorado recently became the first state to approve a so-called right-to-try law, which supporters say may give dying patients the opportunity to try investigational drugs that haven't been approved by the FDA. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about Right to Try, which Arizonans will vote on later this year. Plus, ASU announced a partnership with Starbucks this week that would give thousands of the coffee company's employees the chance to receive full tuition reimbursement if they enroll in the school's online program. I'll talk to a higher education expert to find out whether we're on the cusp of a trend. Also, trauma surgeon Dr. Peter Ree became widely known for his work on former Representative Gabrielle Giffords and other victims of the 2011 Tucson shootings. We'll talk about that January 8th day and advances in Dr. Ree's field. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, I'll talk with trauma surgeon Dr. Peter Ree, who is best known for his work on former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and others who were shot on January 8th of 2011 in Tucson. Ree's new book is called Trauma Red. Also, Colorado has become the first state to approve the so-called Right to Try legislation. Supporters say it would give extremely ill patients the opportunity to try investigational drugs that haven't been approved by the FDA. Arizonans will get to vote on the issue later this year. We'll talk about it. Plus, candidates are challenging each other's petition signatures, and the executive director of the Clean Elections Commission is calling for a full investigation of Tom Horn's possible campaign violations. It is an election year, after all. I'll check in with Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times for a recap. And a new exhibit at the Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum presents a lot of different takes on books. I'll talk to the associate curator. We start today's program with the news that on Monday, ASU announced a new partnership with Starbucks. It would give thousands of the coffee company's employees the chance to receive full tuition reimbursement if they enroll in the school's online program. Philip Regeer is dean of ASU Online. He says the agreement will provide significant benefits to the university.
It allows us to expand our access mission to include more students. Starbucks actually has over 3,000 students just in Arizona alone, and so we'll be able to reach them. The other thing that's true is that online education gets better like anything on the Internet. Online education gets better as you scale it, as you get larger, and so this is going to give us an opportunity to improve our services, improve our courses.
So what kind of impact could the partnership have on other universities or other businesses? With me to talk about that is Dr. Robert Zemsky, professor in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania and chair of the Learning Alliance for Higher Education. Dr. Zemsky, what are your thoughts initially about the Starbucks-Arizona State combination?
Well, I'm a little puzzled by it, to be honest. It makes sense if the ASU online is a full, mature online, because that Starbucks employees are literally all over the world, different time zones, different things like that. If ASU is using this contract to sort of come up to scale, I'd be a little dubious. The online that I know best is APUS, American Public University System. That's the online group that did the same thing with Walmart that ASU is trying to do with Starbucks. And, you know, I've been through the APUS system, and it's very impressive, but it's, you know, it's 10 years in development, a whole system of rules of dealing with faculty, system of understanding how to work with the students. So what I would ask ASU is, are you experienced enough to pull this off?
Okay. So does it seem like a little bit of hype to you?
I don't think it's hype. It may be overreach if there's a difference between. Hype would be they didn't really have the contract. I suspect Michael Crow and ASU really has the contract. It's just a little skepticism about if they have a mature enough system to deliver what Starbucks thinks it's getting.
Could this, let's phrase it this way. What could this foretell for other future partnerships potentially, and would those partnerships have to involve universities as huge as Arizona State, perhaps other large state universities?
It would have to involve a unit that has a fully mature online system. And it's not just the course material. There's registration. There are faculty. For example, the APUS, they have a limit of 25 students per course, so they need lots of teaching faculty. They have them from all over the world. So that if this works, it says what you need to be in this game is a big platform, a big base, and lots of credibility. And the number of public universities who might be able to offer that, I think, is somewhat limited.
Hmm. Are you skeptical about online education generally?
No, I'm being impressed with what it can do, but it's really more of a spot market than a soup-to-nuts market. And I think that's what this thing says. They want to pick up the juniors and the seniors, fill in the, assuming that the person already has a transcript, but it's not complete. I think that's the kind of market it works for. I don't think it works for the 17-year-old who just got out of high school and is going to sit home and go to college. I think that what's clever about the Starbucks deal is if you know their workforce, it's a pretty articulate workforce if you go into Starbucks. I live there, I think, sometimes. If I was going to try to pull it off, I think actually Starbucks would be better to pull it off with than Walmart. But again, it's not so much the students at issue, it's the whole system of support for the instructional activity.
From a big picture standpoint, does this indicate anything to you, even if you're not particularly familiar with what Arizona State does, let's say at the core level, in a more general sense, does this indicate something that shows us in some sense how higher education is changing, how the push to get even more degrees, and there's pressure on that, especially for a state university?
Well, remember I told you the experiment I was familiar with was the Walmart contract with APUS.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
And I know the APUS people really well. It did not produce nearly the enrollments that they thought it would. In part, it had to do with the Walmart workforce, as I understand it. Also had to do with the financial arrangements. But just whether those people really want that kind of education or not. It certainly has an interesting idea that you're going to pick up big employers who have worldwide operations. The grand model of this is actually the University of Maryland, which ran all that stuff everywhere for the military for so long, still does, and runs it online. But it's not a bonanza. Not only a few players are going to be able to serve this market. Some will say you need to be the first mover in the market. Some will say it's better to be the second mover so that you cannot make the mistakes the first mover made. But I don't think it portends that all of higher education is going to look like this. I think you're probably at best talking about 5% of the market, I would guess.
And 5% of the market, you think, in the immediate future, or 5% of the market if we look several years down the road?
Several years down the road.
Okay. There are some who've expressed concern, whether it's Walmart or Starbucks, that a large university is in some sense getting into bed with a business. Is that naive, or does that make sense to you?
No, that's naive.
Okay.
Walmart has people who need education. Walmart has funds. Starbucks is the same thing. You make a deal and it works and you supply a good product. There's nothing amoral, immoral, or suspicious about that.
What about comparing a research university to the idea of a smaller liberal arts school? At any point when we talk about that 5% of the market, could there be in the future some smaller universities in California or in the East Coast that decide, I like this idea, maybe we can do something with a smaller local business?
Well, it turns out, you don't know this, I'm actually a trustee of Whittier College, which is one of those small liberal arts colleges in California.
Yeah.
We, as trustees and as the college, we keep looking at it. I think the judgment that I have from that experience is we don't have a big enough platform to do it on our own. We need to do it in partnership. And it's been very hard to develop those partnerships. So I think it's pretty clear that only the big enterprises are going to play this role. Whatever is going to be the help the struggling liberal arts colleges, this isn't it.
Dr. Robert Zemsky is professor in the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania, also chair of the Learning Alliance for Higher Education. Dr. Zemsky, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. On January 8th of 2011, a Congress on Your Corner event in Tucson turned tragic when six people were shot and killed. 13 others, including then-U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords, were injured. In the days immediately following the shootings, the trauma team at Tucson University Medical Center became familiar faces. One of those doctors was Peter Ree, the chief of trauma, critical care, burn, and emergency surgery.
Well, I'll try to give you a brief update, try to avoid giving too much detail so we don't get the information to the families in the wrong order. So far, what we have at this hospital is we have received 10 patients. Of those, one died.
Can you tell us if the congresswoman is one of the deceased?
No, the congresswoman is not deceased.
Can you tell us her condition currently?
She is in critical condition. The neurosurgeons have finished operating on her, and I can tell you at the current time period, I'm very optimistic about recovery.
Dr. Ree has written a new book. It's called Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities. In the book, he writes about going for a run on January the 8th and being called about the tragic situation and having a sense of calm about how it was going to be handled. I started our conversation earlier by asking him how he was so confident.
Well, I think it comes as a part of the job. You have to like what you do. It's a very stressful job. It's one where we make life and death decisions, and I think the people that are in my field usually strive on that type of pressure. So in a media frenzy that like it was due to the VIP that was involved, being calm, I guess, is part of our nature.
What did you make of the attention paid to you and your team, especially because of Representative Giffords?
It's a double-edged sword. We have those type of tragedies that go on in most American cities all the time. But violence due to guns are basically invisible, I think, to the American public. And while it was good that Congresswoman Giffords got the attention that she got, and our hospital and institution got a lot of the credit for being involved and participating, it was a little bittersweet that this kind of problem that we see in our country that is not better known.
You write about the horrible tragedy of Christina Taylor Greene and all the other people, but the way you describe it in the book is so intense. Is there a way you could sort of relate what was in the book to our listeners?
Sometimes those are just factuals, just like the police officers and firemen and everybody else who are in this field. You just come on to it, and you have to really be concrete, and you have to pay attention to pertinent facts in order to make decisions. I think the details are something that you come back on and think about later on as you put a life to it. There are times when you have to put your emotions to a side and be very intellectual, and then there are times that you need to turn your emotions back on, especially when you talk to the patient and the family and have empathy as to what's going on.
How much experience, how many hours does it take to have the kind of ability to defray the emotions and just know that, okay, we've done this many times before? I think some people in a much lighter way would relate it to why certain athletes practice and practice and practice, because when the big moment comes, you have to have been able to have repeatable sort of motions or knowing that you can repeat the best that you can do. How much work and how much time did it take for you to get to that level?
Well, I think sometimes in many senses we work in a vacuum, so we don't really get that feedback of how well we did. You know, at the end of the day, at the end of the shift, after the 24 hours that you do, you don't really get the applause and you don't get a scoreboard. It's something that you have to know from down deep that you did a good job. The things that you take home with you, the things that you worry about the things that you did the night before. We look for perfection, so therefore we're always continuing to strive and improve. I think that we work under immense pressure and time, and it's a lot of hours that we put in. Our job is fairly grueling, probably averages over 70 to 80 hours a week for the average surgeon. So it is years and years and years of doing this. I feel that although I'm the most senior surgeon in our trauma institution, I still feel like I'm learning every single time.
What's the most difficult decision or series of decisions you've had to make as a trauma surgeon? In a general sense, when you decide, is there an either-or choice you've had to make, or the lady or the tiger kind of choice?
Oh, we do that all the time, and I keep telling our trainees that that's why we get the big bucks. We do have to make the difficult decisions and help the families through this process. There are many situations when we do end-of-life care, when the body may be surviving, but the brain is not. And the brain, for all practical purposes, is brain dead. And in that sense, the soul is dead, the person is dead, but the body's alive. Making those types of decisions as to what's futile care, and even in patients who are not yet brain dead, but to say the quality of life is not going to be what the patient or the family expected, and to help the patients and the natural course of history go forward, I think that's one of the hardest decisions to make. Because you do take on that responsibility that when you face that family and you make that recommendation and you help them guide through that process, you always second-guess yourself and to say, is this the right decision to make? Is there absolutely no chance of recovery? I think those kinds of calls are very difficult to make, but has to be done all the time.
Dr. Reed, what are some of the most exciting advances in your field or things that we should look ahead to?
Right now, we're also starting on a new exciting research, which I think is one of my passions, which is called emergency preservation, or sometimes known as suspended animation, which where we try to cool the brain and the heart immediately when they come from trauma. And if you were killed from a traumatic accident and you come into the medical system quickly, if the time is short enough, we now want to try cooling your brain and your heart in order to give us a little bit more time so that we can fix the injury, so then we can bring you back to life afterwards. So this is a study that we're starting to do in clinical trials, starting off in Pittsburgh and Maryland, but University of Arizona and Tucson is a part of that consortium.
Dr. Reed, you actually said someone could be technically dead? I want to make sure I heard you correct.
When I did this research 10, 15 years ago, I think it really changed my perspective on life completely, because what we normally have been taught is dead is not necessarily true in all circumstances. We know that in the Great Lakes area, when you fall into a frozen lake, that you can be revived even up to an hour afterwards. So it's this ability to cool the brain down very quickly that gives us more time. So when your heart is not functioning and it's not beating blood to the brain, I think that by most people's current definition is when we think that we are dead. But if we can get to the brain and cool it down quickly right after the cessation of blood flow, we find that we can have an hour, maybe two, maybe even 3 hours to buy the time necessary in order to fix your injuries. So during that time period, you are, I guess, technically dead.
To some extent, you became a celebrity of sorts. Did that help the work you did?
Well, I think, yeah, like everything, you know, everything's got a double-edged sword to it. I think there's been many things from our trauma institution that the limelight and headlines did get us, so that there was some appreciation of the team members and the other people who work in our field and get notoriety from that aspect. I think that overall for the institution, it was great and fabulous, and both the university and from the hospital aspects. I think the only person that was harmed by all the media attention was probably myself. I think that on a personal level, this is not necessarily beneficial. I don't get anything personally out of this, and I think professionally from my colleagues, sometimes it's looked upon badly as well. So, but I do this because I think overall, it's good for my profession, it's good for the university, and it's better for the greater good of our society.
Dr. Peter Reed, the Chief of Trauma, Critical Care, Burn, and Emergency Surgery at Tucson's University Medical Center. His new book is called Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about church security in the wake of last week's attack on two priests, one of whom was killed. And then later on this hour, we'll find out about the latest at the state capitol, including a lot of challenges of signatures right now. Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times will join us. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Indian Gaming Association. Tribal gaming benefits Arizonans with nearly $1 billion, supporting education, trauma care, conservation, tourism in local cities and towns. More at benefitingarizona.org.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM. Checking temperatures around the state right now, sunny and 68 degrees in Flagstaff. It's sunny and 76 in Prescott, sunny and 91 in Casa Grande. Tucson reporting partly sunny skies and 93 degrees. It's sunny and 90 in Yuma. Here's a World Cup update. Spain faces Chile today at noon, and Cameroon will play Croatia later on this afternoon. In the day's first game, the Netherlands beat Australia 3-2. In Valley traffic on the State Route 51 northbound, there's a crash blocking four lanes at Greenway. Right now, only the HOV lane is getting by. It's mostly sunny and 93 degrees in Phoenix at 11:26.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Last week, a Catholic priest was killed and another severely beaten by a man who broke into the church, presumably with the intention to rob the facility. Phoenix Police Chief Daniel Garcia.
What the city of Phoenix experienced on June 12, waking up to this horrific crime, was something that we felt also. The urgency to bring this violent felony offender to justice.
The suspect in the killing of Father Kenneth Walker and the assault of Father Joseph Terra is 54-year-old Gary Michael Moran. So should security at churches and other places of worship be improved, and what are some ways to make that happen? With me for a few minutes from Florida is Alan Hughes, who writes and blogs at the site safeatchurch.info. Alan, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Alan, give us some idea of your background, how you got involved in this kind of thing, and what you think is the most important aspect.
Well, initially, my career was in law enforcement, and specifically, I had a lot of experience in protective services, doing personal protection. And as I moved into a larger church that had a need for a safety program, I became involved in it.
Is there a level of security in general that makes sense, and should we be even more security conscious now?
I think there's a need for some level of security at in most places, actually. But a lot of that's going to be dictated by the geography, where it's located at, and by the local climate, really. Obviously, someplace in a rural area may not need as much as a church that's located in a inner city area.
And I wonder, Alan, are there certain things we should know about, certain security advances? I mean, are there a lot of churches that have security cameras, or they have security alarms, for example?
This is a growing field. It's kind of unfortunate that it's a growing field, but it is a reaction to the times that we do live in. And I think it's a responsible move on the part of churches and other houses of worship to put the safety of their attendees into somewhat of a priority. And a lot of what we're seeing now, there is some electronics as far as cameras and that kind of thing. A lot of it is still just people. It's people with eyes on what's going on around them, and just using that experience that they have as adults to see what doesn't feel right to them, what doesn't look right to them, and then knowing who to report it to and having a process for them to report it.
I want to make sure I don't make an incorrect stereotype here, because that would certainly not be fair. In churches and temples and other places of worship, for example, there is certainly part of the mission is to help those who are less fortunate. Sometimes folks who are less fortunate may look suspicious to some people. How do we balance that out?
And that's always a factor, because you're correct. That is part of the mission. It is the mission. Churches are not museums for the perfect. They're a hospital for the sick and the broken. And those broken and sick people need the church as much as anyone. And that's always a balancing act. That's why there's somewhat of a gap where, like a government building that you may go into and you may find security with metal detectors and armed guards and people have to be checked in and that sort of thing. Well, you can't really do that in a church. So there's a balancing act between the church's mission and what we can do to make it as safe as possible while still making it welcome to those who need to be there the most.
Alan, do you hear from people who are concerned about additional security where they feel like, well, this is a church, it should be open to all, we shouldn't have to worry about this?
Well, the church is open to all. We don't, I'm speaking from my experience, we don't exclude anyone. Everyone is welcome. You can't influence people that you won't associate with. But we still take measures to ensure that everyone is safe. So there again, it's sort of a balancing act, and there are people everywhere that we go that don't feel that there's a need for security in a church, and I wish that were the case, but it simply isn't realistic to think that no church needs a security program.
And I'm focused primarily, obviously, on safety, but I also know of churches that perhaps have things they consider to be valuable in terms of material things, and so they lock up. And so there are some that also say, well, the church should be open. I mean, people are not, we're not an 8-to-5 world where we only need to pray or go to a house of worship during those times.
Well, I grew up in a very rural area, and I grew up with one of those churches that did. The front door was always unlocked. It was open. This is not the same era or the same area that I grew up in. You're correct. There are, you know, thousands of dollars worth of electronics, and as the stewards of the money that has been given to the church, we bear a responsibility to use it wisely and to protect it.
Alan, finally, I wanted to get your personal opinion on this, because one of the things that came out of the attack in Phoenix last week was that one of the priests had a gun, and it was taken from him, allegedly by the assailant, or the person carrying out the assault. What are your thoughts on that from a general standpoint, as far as a person, regardless of your feelings on the Second Amendment, do you feel like someone who is a priest or a pastor or a rabbi should have a gun?
I don't know that I'm really qualified to comment on the theological implications of it. You know, I would defer to their, denomination. As for my personal point of view, I think that the Bible justifies self-defense, and it would justify the most efficient use of, you know, whatever was available to us. In this case, it may be a firearm. In other cases, like we saw in Seattle about a week ago at Seattle Pacific University, a student volunteer ended up subduing an armed assailant with pepper spray.
Right.
He just made do with what he had available.
Alan Hughes writes and blogs at the site safeatchurch.info. He joined us from Florida. Alan, thanks so much for your insights. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last month, Colorado became the first state to approve so-called right-to-try legislation. Supporters say it will allow terminally ill patients to use experimental medications that haven't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Opponents say right-to-try will actually have a negative effect on the development of newer and safer drugs. Arizonans will have the opportunity to vote on a right-to-try ballot initiative in the fall. The Goldwater Institute is a prime mover behind the measure. With me for a few minutes is a supporter of right-to-try, Paulina Morris. Paulina, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background, why Right to Try is so personal for you?
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Steve. The reason why it's so important, Proposition 303 and Right to Try for my family, is my son Diego was diagnosed at the age of 11 with osteosarcoma and went through an extensive amount of chemotherapy and cancer treatment. And it was brought to our attention that there was a drug that was showing very promising results with osteosarcoma patients in trials here in the United States. And the drug was approved in just about every other country. And we decided we needed to get that drug for our child and save his life and move to London for 9 months. Mm. And we want to make sure that children and adults, people here in Arizona, have access to drugs that haven't gone through the lengthy FDA process, but have passed basic safety tests and make it available to people here in Arizona.
How is Diego doing now?
He's doing very well, thank you. He's cancer-free, thank God, and busy in school. He's 13 and busy with junior high and academics and sports and social activities.
So how frustrated did his experience make you with the current system of drug approval?
Incredibly frustrated. I mean, you can imagine the trauma that you face when your child has a life-threatening illness, terminal illness, dealing with all of the shock and medical facts and decisions you have to make for your child, and then learning that you can't get access to drugs here in the United States is incredibly frustrating, to put it mildly.
So, Paulina, what did Diego's doctors say to you, whether on the record or off? Were they empathetic? Did they try to convince you to do other things as opposed to going to England?
Well, no. We spoke to physicians around the country and around the world, actually, who had worked with this drug, who believed in it, and were very realistic with us. So physicians who were familiar with the drug were quite positive about seeking this drug if we could do it. It's very difficult for families to just pick up and move to another country. So the problem is, Steve, is that when you're here in the U.S. and a drug hasn't been approved by the FDA, it's really not even raised as an issue with the physicians caring for your loved one. Why would they, since it's impossible to get it here in the U.S.? So it was actually a friend of ours who's a physician, a radiation oncologist, who brought this drug to our attention, brought the studies and the research and data, and said, you know, if it were my child, and he felt that Diego was like his child, he would go and seek this treatment.
Paula, let me delve into a little bit more into Prop 303, the right to try measure. Some people are afraid there isn't enough regulation necessarily. Others are concerned that insurance companies wouldn't be required to pay for treatment. Any thoughts on this being a concern of a have and have nots? Those who have a little bit more as far as financial resources could try things that maybe those who don't have that income couldn't.
But that's the issue right now, Steve. I mean, children, adults don't have access to these drugs and can't move to another country. That's incredibly cost prohibitive. It's been very difficult for my family. So talk about the haves and the have-nots. We should have access to these drugs in the United States and make it even realistic to people here who can't just pick up and go.
Paulina, from your perspective then, is this a case of big government getting in the way, or does the FDA have legitimate reasons for holding off on some of these?
You know, this isn't about politics. This is about saving families. It's about saving lives. It's incredibly difficult for people to pick up and move to another country. It was difficult for my family and, you know, my younger son, and uprooting him from his school and his friends and his family. And when you think about it, Steve, healthcare isn't just about the drugs. It's also about being around your loved ones and your friends and your support system and being in your own bed. And we had to leave our puppy at the time. And so many things that go into treating illness we didn't have because we had to be in another country.
Paulina, finally, there are some also who are concerned that even if Arizona voters do approve Prop 303, that there will still be federal restrictions, that the FDA would still have some overseeing power. Is that a concern as well, that people might get very emotional about this, vote in favor, and then it won't actually do anything?
Well, no, and I look at it as, you know, many good things in our country have started it at the state level. I think it was Justice Brandeis who said states are the laboratories of democracy. So many good things occur at the state and local level, and with federal oversight. It's provided for in our fabric, in our Constitution.
Paulina Morris is a supporter of Right to Try, Proposition 303. Arizona voters will have their chance to vote on it in November. Paulina, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
And we'll be hearing from an opponent of Proposition 303 in the weeks to come on Here and Now as well. Still to come on this program, we'll talk with Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times about petition signature madness and other happenings in state politics. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Duet, a local nonprofit helping homebound elders, family caregivers, faith community nurses, and grandparents raising grandchildren. Volunteer, donate, or ask for help at duetaz.org.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Sunny and a high of 101 expected for the valley tonight. It'll be clear tonight with an overnight low in the mid-70s, and then more sunshine tomorrow with a high of 102. In valley traffic, on the State Route 51, the northbound lanes are now back open at Greenway, while on the Loop 101 in the West Valley, there's a crash on the shoulder that's southbound at Glendale Road. Stay with us at 12 for NPR's Here and Now. Fears are growing that the conflict in Iraq will soon become a full-blown sectarian war. And American Airlines is cutting its flights to Venezuela, saying the government there owes it $750 million in ticket revenue. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon on KJZZ. Mostly sunny skies and 93 degrees in Phoenix at 1141.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. One famous name will no longer be on the ballot in Arizona's 7th Congressional District, and I don't mean Mary Rose Wilcox, Ruben Gallego. Even though Wilcox does apparently have issues with Gallego's name, the one I'm talking about is Cesar Chavez, who's actually better known as Scott Fistler. If you're confused at this point, then it's time to turn to Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times to catch us up on the latest election news and hopefully not confuse us even more. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you doing, Steve?
Good. So, what happened with Scott Fistler, Cesar Chavez? Is he done now?
He is, for the time being, at least off of the ballot. A judge ruled yesterday morning that he didn't qualify for the ballot. There were a number of arguments made about why he should be kicked off the ballot, but the one the judge settled on was the fact that an analysis by the Maricopa County Recorder's Office showed that roughly half of the 1,400 signatures he submitted to get on the ballot were from voters who either from people who either weren't voters or folks who were just ineligible to sign his petition because, say, they were Republicans or Libertarians or they lived outside of the 7th Congressional District. And that left him several hundred short of the minimum that he needed to qualify for the ballot. And so he has been ruled off. He said he plans to appeal that ruling directly to the Supreme Court. If he's going to do so, he has about nine more days, I think it's the 27th, in order to file that appeal. But in this kind of a situation, it's unlikely that such an appeal would be successful.
So, Jim, to understate this a little bit, Scott Fistler, Cesar Chavez, is a bit of a character. Can you tell us more about him?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a kind of a circus yesterday. You know, he was grandstanding a little bit for the crowd that had gathered to watch this hearing. You know, he represented himself in court, didn't have an attorney, you know, was kind of wearing this, you know, an outfit that kind of drew attention to himself, a little bit of a kind of a I don't know, almost iconic, like movie kind of gangster sort of outfit, pinstripe shirt, rosary beads around, you know, pinky ring, the whole thing. Definitely was mugging for the cameras and trying to put on a little bit of a show for the media that had gathered. At one point after the hearing, when he was talking to some reporters, he basically said, look, I'm hoping you guys get my message out there. That way people will start funneling money into my campaign so I can hire an attorney to defend myself.
Yeah, but Jim, what is his message?
He doesn't really have a message. His message is basically, I'm Cesar Chavez, I think voters know who I am, and I think it's obviously clear that voters don't know who he is. I mean, no one really knows who he is. Like, he's only been Cesar Chavez for about 7 months right now, and so that was, you know, kind of part of the issue, I think, surrounding the effort to try to get him off the ballot.
Other candidates, Jim, had their signatures challenged, too, including Representative Ethan Orr from Southern Arizona. Also, Toby Farmer, who's running against Don Shooter in the GOP primary. Can you compare and contrast those? Tell us more about those.
Yeah, the Toby Farmer one's interesting. The court, Maricopa County Superior Court judge yesterday afternoon, ruled that Toby Farmer can stay on the ballot. At issue was about a half dozen signatures that were allegedly forged, names and signatures that were forged on these nominating petitions that Toby Farmer claimed to have circulated. State law says that if a candidate forges signatures, that they are to be kicked off the ballot and disqualified from holding elected office for another 5 years. They made the case, the Don Shooter's attorneys made the case that Toby Farmer forged these signatures. The judge, however, said while it's clear that there were some, that there were forgeries, there's very little doubt about that. There's no evidence that Toby Farmer, A, knew about it, or B, did it. And so for that reason, the most he could do was basically throw out those signatures. But he was reticent to say, without really much in the way of evidence, that it was Toby Farmer who did the forgeries, and you know, basically giving him the candidate death penalty.
Jim, as far as Ethan Orr is concerned, time for some political analysis from you, okay? Ethan Orr is considered to be, I don't know if he's the most liberal Republican in the legislature, but certainly one of them, if not the most. So why are Democrats so eager to get him off the ballot?
Because they want to have a Democrat in the seat. Frankly, he's a Republican who's elected in a Democratic district. And yes, he is a moderate Republican. He's one of the more moderate members of the Arizona House Republican Caucus, has worked with Democrats on a number of issues. But, you know, they saw an opportunity to try to get him off the ballot. If they do that, then both the Democratic candidates will win. There's no other Republican running. And you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, partisan politics is partisan politics. And you know, the Democrats, while they're happy to work with a guy like Ethan Orr in the legislature when he's elected, when it comes to campaigning, they don't want him to get reelected. They'd much rather have someone on their team get elected. And so that was the effort that you saw. The case was dismissed. The Pima County Recorder's Office did their analysis of the signatures that were being challenged, and they determined that there were not enough challenged in that to disqualify him from the ballot, so the lawsuit was withdrawn. Interestingly enough, though, we have heard from a number of Democrats who have quietly been complaining about this challenge and saying, look, you don't go after this guy unless you're absolutely positive you can get him off the ballot, because now you've just taken someone who has been an approachable, who has been an ally on a lot of issues, and you've really kind of poisoned the well with this guy. And so now when you're going to go to him, he gets reelected, and you need to go to him, you know, next January or February or March to try to work on an issue, he may not be as likely to work with you.
So, Jim, is this typical for an election year, then, this idea, all the petition signature challenges, is this just part of the cycle?
It is. It's really part of the dance, and everyone knows what's coming. I mean, I think statewide there was something like between, you know, city elections and county elections. I mean, you know, you're looking at like 40 or 50 challenges total. It's a busy time of year for reporters, you know, from everyone covering the state level races like we do, all the way down to you know, city governments. Reporters are trying to keep track of this stuff. Election attorneys are working overtime this time of year. Judges and court personnel are really scrambling, you know, to get this stuff done. They've got a limit of 10 days to hear all these cases, and you know, I think we've got a few more days this week of court hearings, and then it all kind of wraps up, and everyone moves on to the campaign and actually gets onto the issues.
All right, Jim, one more about related to Tom Horn. We've heard a lot about Tom Horn. This doesn't have to do with anything underhanded per se necessarily, but Clean Elections Commission Executive Director Tom Collins now wants a deeper investigation of Tom Horn.
Yeah, this actually stems from the allegations that were made by former Horn employee and campaign volunteer Sarah Beatty a couple of weeks ago. There was a complaint that was filed with the Secretary of State's office and with the Clean Elections Commission, basically calling for an investigation of Tom Horn improperly using his office to and office resources and staff time to conduct his campaign. And the Clean Elections Executive Director is recommending that the commission take up this investigation and look into the allegations and try to get to the bottom of it. The commission, the five commissioners, will meet tomorrow morning to decide whether to proceed with that.
And, Jim, finally, some endorsements this week, including Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach endorsing Michelle Reagan's Secretary of State run, Joe Arpaio endorsing Tom Horn. So how important are endorsements this time around?
You know, it depends on the race and on the candidate and on the person who's giving the endorsement. You know, I think a Joe Arpaio endorsement has always, I think, typically been a pretty important one. You know, no doubt that's something I think that's a boost to Tom Horn, a very beleaguered Tom Horn, someone who's gone through, had a lot of bad news surrounding his name in recent months. And as far as the Chris Kobach one for Michelle Reagan, I think that's another one that is probably maybe more important than most endorsements, if only because Michelle Reagan is I think generally perceived as the most moderate Republican in the Secretary of State's race, and Chris Kobach is really an icon for conservative voters. He's been, you know, very made his mark on immigration reform with things like Senate Bill 1070, and you know, nationally in terms of you know, election laws, really trying to crack down on what he sees as opportunities for voter fraud happening. And so to have someone like him in her corner, I think, is definitely a boost to Michelle Reagan's campaign.
Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times. You can follow him on Twitter at Jim Small. Jim, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Books aren't just for reading anymore, even though that's a pretty valuable service they've been providing. The South Gallery at Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum at the Mesa Arts Center has an exhibit on display expanding on books as works of art. It's called Boundless, The Book Transformed in Contemporary Art. Tiffany Farrell, Associate Curator at Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum, is with me to tell us more. Tiffany, good morning.
Good morning.
So give us the general premise of this concept.
Well, when we were putting this exhibition together, we were looking at books. You know, artists use a variety of mediums to create works. And we noticed how artists were creating these incredible works of art and sculpture made out of books. I mean, today books, you know, they're a tangible resource, but they're also kind of an obsolete medium. You know, we use them, but now with digital technology, digital resources, a lot of them are being discarded. And what do you do with those? Mm-hmm. You can recycle them. You can, you know, maybe hold on to them. But nowadays, some of the artists are taking library books, books that have been discarded at estate sales, and just a variety of different resources to find these books and create these incredible works of art from them.
And looking at some of the photos, some of the ones that stood out to me, of course, books turned into what looks like the Grand Canyon. How about a phone book turned into the face of Pee Wee Herman? I thought that was amazing.
That's a fun piece, the Pee Wee Herman one. It's very clever, too. Taking this phone book, again, something you would recycle, you usually toss away after a year. And he actually sculpted the, if you actually look on the piece, it's actually in the piece section for Pee Wee Herman.
Wow, I didn't even
very
look that
clever.
Close. Okay. What were the requirements of the artists taking part? I mean, was there a situation, I don't know how this works, did you go out and seek people? Did you say, this is what we're looking for? Give us an idea of what you can bring?
Sure. We actually call those exhibitions invitational exhibitions. Okay. So it was an invitational. We invited artists to show their work. And it's kind of an interesting area of art, too, because there are things called art books. But that is completely different than what we're looking at here. We're looking at artists that have altered books. These are pre-existing materials. These aren't like illuminated manuscripts. These are altered. And so we looked at artists that specifically dealt with that, taken a book, altered it, and made it a new form.
Did these artists in any way share a particular affection for books, or was this just sort of their medium?
Both. Okay. Some do. Some have a true affiliation for the books. Others just go, wow, this is a cool medium.
I think I'd like to have you describe some of them. In fact, one that stood out to me was, more than one, but Julia Strand. I wonder if you could describe some of what she brought.
Julia Strand. Well, she does the beautiful carved books.
Right. It was amazing. It's almost like you can,
yes.
You know what it reminded me of, which is ridiculous, is those old, at Christmas time, the old Lifesavers
yes.
books, where you have the little sort of hole in the middle and you flip through it.
Absolutely. And that's amazing. Her and Doug Beebe are the artists that really did the incredible carved books in the show, where they basically just remove, it's excavating the book, removing the layers, and just creating the scenes then, and allowing them to be sculptures of them all.
I'm sure it's different for each artist, but mm-hmm. on average, how long did it take people to do this?
Gosh, I don't know, actually. Some of them take months. Some of them are much more fast. You know, Mike Stilke actually does his books more quickly because they're painted books.
Right.
So he's altering the books, not in the way of carving them, but just painting on their surfaces.
But when you talk about the invitation, how far in advance did that go? And did the artists, was part of the work already done? Or was this a case of, this is something I'd like to try and this exhibit would be a great fit for me?
Yes. When we start programming out at least a year and a half out. But we start contacting artists. Some artists are contacted even close up to the show 6 months out. But the invitation, we try producing a few months away from the show. And artists are constantly working on artwork. Sometimes we're getting new work. Sometimes it's pre-existing work. It just all depends what the artist has in inventory, because their galleries are also showing them.
Is there anything like this that you can think of, this idea of using a medium that is so well known for one thing mm-hmm. it's being transformed into another. I suppose, as you mentioned, as technology changes, that might be occurring in other ways as well.
Absolutely, all throughout the art world. When you look at art today, it's really hard to categorize artists. And I think we have a tendency to try to categorize people, whether, you know, oh, this artist is strictly a Native American artist, or specifically, this artist is only a craft artist. But now people are intermixing so many other mediums, they're intermixing so many different ideas and merging that you just really can't pinpoint one. That artist is one specific thing.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Tiffany Farrell, Associate Curator at Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum. We're talking about the exhibit Boundless, the book transformed in contemporary art. In a general sense, Tiffany, I think when people think art, obviously they can think so many different things. Is there a way to define contemporary art?
Contemporary art usually refers to art being produced now.
Okay.
It talks about contemporary culture, what's going on today. It used to basically describe art produced after World War II. Now it's even gone even further than that, I think. You're looking at maybe anything past the 1940s and 50s is, definitely contemporary art.
My perception was more that it had more to do with a certain style as opposed to an actual when it was produced, but that's not right.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it's usually, about when it's produced.
Okay, so contemporary style can be anything, because I think when people think of art museums, there can be so many different varieties of things. Do you get a certain kind of person who comes to the Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum, or is there a whole variety of people?
Well, we actually have tried to, the problem with art museums, sometimes we have a tendency to talk down to people. And with us, we're really trying not to do that. We want to really make people feel comfortable, invite everybody. This is for anybody. You don't have to be an elite art historian to really understand what's going on with this art. And that's the fun thing about art, is it relates to everybody on a certain level. We have such a diversity of exhibitions. Perhaps you will not like one show, or perhaps you won't like a piece, but then you'll have another piece that really resonates with you. And so that's really what we're trying to do. We've had other shows in the past where we've had a lowrider show, we've had tattoo shows, and so it's not just strictly about high fine art.
Not to get you in trouble with the artists, but are there any couple from Boundless that, not that you like more, but that you thought were especially interesting?
Oh, sure. Actually, I was very drawn to the Grand Canyon piece. That was actually one of my favorites. I really wanted that piece.
Well, can you describe that a little bit? Because I know I can't.
Sure. It's by an artist named Guy Lemire. And Lemire, it's French, but it's, he's an incredible artist who's gotten a lot of press these days. And his pieces are actually carved out of encyclopedias. A lot of them are usually encyclopedias, and they look like eroding landscapes. So he specifically is focused on the Grand Canyon, but he uses the eroding landscapes to talk about eroding culture and eroding how things erode and decay over time, just like the landscapes. And it's kind of like that with the books, because they're an eroding culture.
And it's truly amazing to see. Tiffany Farrell is Associate Curator at Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum. Again, the exhibit's called Boundless, the book transformed in contemporary art. Tiffany, thanks for the time today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much for listening. Also, special thanks to Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on today's program. If you missed part of it, or you want to hear one of our past editions of Here and Now, you can go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. And now we head to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 noon.